So when you start to break down the trust, it may make that very rich and very powerful collaboration more of a problem.
Apparent Chinese spying at U.S. medical institutions. It's Tuesday, November 5th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a failing grade for North Korea sanctions, tough living in a Pakistani city, the latest on U.S. impeachment, the Berlin Wall anniversary, and walking in vegan shoes. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Seventy-one medical institutions, including some of the most prestigious medical schools in the United States, are now investigating 180 cases involving potential theft of intellectual properties. The New York Times on Monday reported that almost all of the people under investigation are of Chinese descent. VOA Asia's Ira Melman got in touch with Dr. Ross McKinney, Chief Scientific Officer of the Association of American Medical Colleges.
Well, it sounds like a lot of people, but when you actually then think about the number of Chinese researchers or researchers of Southeast Asian descent in the United States at our schools of medicine and who are funded by the NIH, there are about 6,000 funded investigators of Asian background that the NIH funds. So the 180 sounds like a lot, but in fact, it's a pretty small proportion of the overall population of Chinese scientists or scientists of Asian descent.
Is it worrisome?
It is worrisome, and what makes it worrisome is because the collaboration between the U.S. and citizens from China who have come to work in our laboratories, who have come to work with our universities, who become collaborators, has been a really strong and rich one. And so when you start to break down the trust, it may make that very rich and very powerful collaboration more of a problem. And that's sad. I mean, we really don't want to see that because of how important these collaborations have been.
Does this threaten all of this? Does this threaten this open exchange of medical information between the U.S. and China?
It raises concerns because there are certain ground rules you expect people in science to follow. You expect people to respect that somebody who has an idea will get to develop their own idea. And once it's developed enough, you can publish it.
How was all this discovered?
It was discovered originally, as best I can tell, at MD Anderson, which is a cancer center in Texas. And they had a case where somebody was sending things to China, PDFs of grant applications, and then started to pursue and discovered that there was a program in China called the Thousand Talents Program that was recruiting scientists. And when the scientists chose not to be recruited to China, was instead funding them to do work in China while remaining on faculty in the U.S. And so that's where the problem began and from where it was uncovered.
Is the U.S. government involved in these investigations?
The U.S. and government is at the core of these investigations. While institutions are asked to do an evaluation, the FBI is engaged and the NIH is involved and is aware of or prompted most of those 180 investigations.
There are those, as you know, who are warning that these Chinese and Chinese-American academics are now feeling at risk, including, of course, those who are not part of this situation, mm-hmm. and this crackdown will stop or stem the flow of researchers from China to the United States. Others are going as far as saying that it's racist. How do you react to that?
I think that it has had a chilling effect, and it is very sad because the issue has not been with the Chinese people. The issue has been with the Chinese government, which was doing this in a systematic way. There are a very high proportion of graduate students in the U.S. in the biomedical sciences who are Chinese by background or citizenship. A lot of our postdocs, people who are continuing to learn new techniques and develop new tools after finishing their PhD, are also of Chinese national descent. And it's been a very rich collaboration. This, unfortunately, makes people suspicious and will make it less appealing to come to the U.S. And that's particularly sad because of how beneficial this relationship has been for decades.
Dr. Ross McKinney, Chief Scientific Officer of the Association of American Medical Colleges. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia headlines that you'll find right now when you make a visit to voanews.com. Vietnam state media says 8 arrested in connection with UK truck death. 2 activist journalists stabbed to death in Indonesia. Vietnam gets a U.S. confidence boost in China Sea dispute. A report says sanctions on North Korea not working, harming civilian population. Most ASEAN leaders, no-shows in meeting with Trump's proxy. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as the voanews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A new report finds sanctions imposed on North Korea are failing to advance denuclearization prospects on the Korean Peninsula while causing immense suffering to the civilian population. An international multidisciplinary panel of independent experts compiled the report. The report is the first comprehensive assessment of the human impact of sanctions against North Korea. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations strengthened economic sanctions against North Korea in 2016 with the aim of bringing Pyongyang to the nuclear negotiating table with Washington. This tactic, however, has not worked. The talks remain deadlocked. While targeted sanctions against North Korea's elite are ineffective, authors of the report say evidence shows they are having a devastating impact on the general population, especially women and children. They say sanctions are adversely affecting humanitarian aid and economic development in the country. They cite UN agencies that report 40% of North Korea's population is going hungry and in desperate need of assistance. 6 out of 10 people do not have access to safe drinking water, and malnutrition among children is increasing. Christine Ahn is founder of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women to end the Korean War. She says the sanctions are barring the import of essential items, including medical equipment, agricultural material essential for food production, and components for water and sanitation programs. She says authors of the report warn the lack of these goods threaten the lives of the most vulnerable people in North Korea.
They assess that nearly 4,000 people died in 2018 as a result of the delays caused by the sanctions of materials and aid coming into North Korea, as well as the funding shortfalls.
Last year, UN agencies were able to raise only 21% of the $111 million they needed for urgent humanitarian programs, leaving a funding gap of $87 million. No progress has been made in nuclear negotiations since U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un held a historic first face-to-face meeting in Singapore last year and signed a declaration promising to transform their relations. Ahn tells VOA the U.S. could advance this goal by partially lifting the sanctions that are hurting the civilian population.
This is something that the United States can do. It wouldn't do anything to cost anything to U.S. taxpayers, and I think it would go a long way to improving the basic security of North Korean people, and it could be a very concrete step towards advancing the step-by-step approach that ultimately will lead to denuclearization and a peace agreement.
Trump and Kim met a second time earlier this year in Hanoi, Vietnam. Those talks, however, ended with no agreement. Ahn says it would be wise to involve women in the U.S.-North Korean nuclear talks. She says research shows when women are engaged in a peace process, their participation actually leads to a peace agreement and one that is more likely to be durable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, U.S. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien denounced China's ongoing military buildup in the South China Sea at a meeting of Southeast Asian leaders in Thailand. China's vice foreign minister criticized what he called meddling by powers outside the region in negotiations to resolve the territorial dispute. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. The United Nations General Assembly recently marked World Cities Day. This year's theme focused on innovations and better life for future generations. Part of that involves ranking cities on their livability. VOA's Arash Arabasadi looks at why one of the world's most populous cities, Karachi, Pakistan, ranks near the bottom.
Karachi is Pakistan's financial and industrial nerve center, but experts say it suffers from chronic underinvestment in city services.
The infrastructure that people commonly use for transportation, for access to drinking water, for the proper functioning of a sewerage system, for disposal of solid waste, those services were obviously not attended. And this situation has continued on for quite a sizable period of time.
To be sure, parts of Karachi are undergoing upgrades, but the city's mayor says much of Karachi's infrastructure needs more upkeep than the city alone can provide.
Karachi ko total revamping chahiye.
No doubt the responsibility lies with government, but the federal government should give special attention to a city with two major ports. Imagine a city like Karachi, mishandled by provincial and federal governments. They went for short-term solutions, but we need a complete revamp of the system.
Once known as the City of Lights, Karachi now holds a far more dubious distinction. It is near the bottom of the Economist Intelligence Unit's annual ranking of cities, which accounts for things like infrastructure, healthcare, and environmental conditions. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, moves to remove the U.S. president. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Hong Kong police said Monday that a 48-year-old knife-wielding man who slashed two people and bit off part of the ear of a local politician during weekend protests has been arrested, along with two men who attacked him in return. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features that you can see and share. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the U.S. Congress made history last week with a vote formally approving a formal impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump. Trump has now become the fourth U.S. president to become the subject of an impeachment investigation based on his alleged efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on what the congressional vote means and what to expect next from Washington.
Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
High drama and history as the Congress moved forward on impeachment, led by the Democratic Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
This is something that is very solemn, that is something prayerful.
Pelosi and many Democrats believe President Trump abused his power by pressuring Ukraine to investigate one of his political rivals, former Vice President Joe Biden.
We take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and that's what we cannot ignore, and we will not ignore when the president's behavior indicates that that investigation, that inquiry is necessary.
House Republicans are unified against impeachment, and Republican leader Kevin McCarthy says Democrats are trying to undo Trump's victory in the 2016 election.
Democrats are trying to impeach the president because they are scared they cannot defeat him at the ballot box. That's not my words. That's the words of my colleagues from the other side of the aisle that has offered impeachment three different times.
The president blasted the impeachment vote on Twitter as a witch hunt and has long vowed to survive any effort to remove him from office.
I've had the Mueller witch hunt, the Russia witch hunt. I have witch hunts every week. I say, what's the witch hunt this week? They can't beat us at the ballot box. They cannot beat us at the ballot box. So they want to try and beat us the old-fashioned way, which is not very nice. They are a nasty group of people.
The resolution.
This latest House vote is about the process of impeachment going forward, says Julie Pace.
This is about the rules that will govern what happens next in terms of public testimony, in terms of what the public does learn about things that happen behind closed doors.
But the vote launched an important new chapter in the impeachment inquiry, says analyst John Hudak.
Part of the reason for doing this is to transition the process to the next stage, which will be a more public stage. But it will also hold Republicans' feet to the fire to disallow them from making process arguments against the inquiry.
It's a process that could drag on for some time, says John Fortier.
In the House of Representatives, probably going to take a couple of months. We're really at the beginning of that period today. If there's a Senate trial, and the Senate Majority Leader said there will be if there's impeachment, that's likely to take another month or two as well. So this could go on for quite a while into next year.
A House vote to impeach the president would be the equivalent of an indictment or accusation of wrongdoing. That would lead to a Senate trial, where senators would decide whether to remove him from office. Public hearings on the impeachment inquiry are expected to begin later this month. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This news break from VOA Asia. The second China International Import Expo officially opens today in Shanghai. The expo will host more than 60 countries and three international organizations at the National Exhibition and Convention Center. You can see this story and more online at VOA 60. And find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, on November 9th, it will be 30 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall, which brought to an end the divide between the communist East and democratic West. The fall of the wall symbolized the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe that was imposed by the then Soviet Union after World War II. It also paved the way for the eventual reunification of Germany, so that today, what was once East Germany is now part of Western Europe. But right-wing parties are gaining strength in former East Germany, threatening the country's stability, as Michael Scatura reports from Berlin.
New films from Berlin show yet more evidence of the colossal damage done.
Berlin was a broken city when the war ended in 1945. And then in 1961 it was divided by the Berlin Wall, built to keep East Germans from fleeing to the West. Fast forward to today, the Berlin Wall is largely gone. The parts that do remain serve as an outdoor museum. Millions visit every year. In the years since the wall fell, East Berlin has caught up to the West. These glittering new apartments were built on what was East Berlin. This Berlin street is known as Little Damascus. Syrians and others fleeing from war have started new businesses and restaurants here. Entrepreneurs from around the world have also come, pumping new life into the city. American tour operator Jeremy Mintzberg is one of them.
And all of a sudden, tourists started coming here, and they realized this is a really cool place to be, and they started telling everybody. And with Brexit happening, a lot of people don't know where they're going to be for with that, and many businesses have decided to relocate here in Berlin.
But graffiti on the walls reflect the frustration by some Berliners that the new arrivals have led to skyrocketing rents.
Everything is becoming unaffordable. It's the San Franciscoization of Berlin. So the average Berliner is having a very, very difficult time keeping up with what all these people with foreign salaries. It is creating a social problem here in Berlin.
Still, Berlin's economy is growing, but the rest of East Germany hasn't fared as well. Though there are a handful of successful cities in the East, much of the former GDR lost its industry when the wall fell. Abandoned factories like this were common. Millions lost their jobs or moved away.
Around 80% of the people lost their job after the wall came down, after the reunification. Many people were desperate to find something new, to find work, and so many people left.
According to Erdmann, there's a strong connection between the rise of right-wing extremism and the collapse of the East German economy after German reunification.
the AfD, the right-wing party here in Germany, has actually quite targeted Eastern states. They have been like immensely successful over there.
Green Party official Jana Brix worries about the rise of right-wing extremism in her country.
For a good democracy, for working democracy, we need a big amount of people who are raised in a democratic way, who think in a democratic way, and I'm afraid that we will lose that. Of course, I'm very, very worried about it. I still think it's not lost, and there's still hope, and we have to work on it, but we can't act like everything is fine.
30 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, young people like Brix are doing their best to preserve German democracy. But as a recent right-wing terrorist attack against the synagogue in the former East Germany demonstrated, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia remain deeply entrenched threats. Michael Scaturo for VOA News, Berlin.
For those people who have removed all animal products out of their diet, making sure they're not wearing anything made from an animal, like fur shoes, seems like a natural progression. In Los Angeles, vegan fashion is a thing, and retailers are doing their best to meet demand for cruelty-free clothing and footwear. One designer in California dedicated all her time and energy to making sneakers that are made from recycled materials and are fully recyclable themselves. Angela Bagsarian has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Cynthia Arcus confesses that it was her son who inspired and pushed her to create her own business.
He was making so many questions, and one of them was like, why we are wasting resources? Why we are wasting so much water? So because of his questions, I was like, wow, yes, and how we could do things different.
Arcus decided she needed to start with herself. That's how the brand Arcus Bear was born, sneakers made of recycled material. The eco-friendly sneakers, though available in many colors, have never been dyed. They were just made from recycled material of similar color.
And dyeing colors, you know, you use water, you are using chemicals. So I was picking and balancing all of this. And we decided to do sustainable sneakers made of recycled rubber and recycled cotton and plastic bottles. Inside is very comfortable. It has coconut fiber.
Old footwear, disfigured and discolored, turns into designer shoes.
Those are pieces of rubber. Those are pieces of other soles that should be discarded. And we decide to reutilize in the production.
Arcus' sneakers shown at the Vegan Fashion Week that took place in Los Angeles early in October. Together with other designers, Arcus wants to prove that eco-friendly doesn't mean ugly. A lot of vegan clothing and shoe items are sold for hefty prices, and there are a whole variety of styles to choose from.
So I was a stylist to celebrities, right? So I was making up and outfits for people, and I was buying up to like $10,000 to $15,000 worth of amazing luxury shoes a month. And I wanted to find a way to make a version that was non-leather and not using any animal cruelty, but also having that same amazing feel, fit, and fashion sense. And so I went out to do it myself.
Rebecca Mink has been making designer vegan shoes for Hollywood celebrities for over 20 years. Apples, pineapples, mushrooms, the materials she uses will astonish any clothing guru. For now, vegan shoes seem to be a U.S. thing. European countries still like their leather. So most vegan designers are exclusive to the U.S., where they know they will find customers. For Angelina Bogdasarian in Los Angeles, Anna Rice, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as another Facebook channel. That's VOA Burmese. So for everyone who is listening in Myanmar on VOA Burmese, we thank you for joining us today. Don't forget, look us up on Twitter and also YouTube and find our videos there. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Keith Holmes, our managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and our interns, Hyung and Afra. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.